Welcome, everybody, to the Diecast Movie Podcast. For this episode, we have a special interview brought to you by my dad. Take it away, Dad.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 195 of the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we do two types of episodes, where we do movie discussions, where we roll a die to decide the genre and the movie we're going to discuss. And we also do interviews. And today, I'm joined in an interview with Carl Craig, star of Gamera vs. Virus, or Destroy All Planets. I got to meet him recently at Monster Bash, and he was gracious enough to say, well, come on the show and join me for an interview. How you doing today, Craig? Mr. Craig.
Perfect. Hanging in there.
So it was wonderful meeting you at the Monster Bash and things like that and going there. And it's also great to hear your voices back because we were going to do the interview back then and you lost your voice.
Yeah, I didn't realize what was going on. Apparently, my daughter was sick before I left, and she must have given it to me, because when I came back from the con, I mean, my whole family was like sounded like frogs. It was bad. It was really bad. So, yeah, I'm much better now, even though I feel like I'm having a relapse again. I started taking some antihistamines again this morning to keep my nose from running and stuff, but I feel much better.
Well, the great thing is you're better, the family's better, and obviously, you know, we're getting to do this now, but the main thing is your health is back.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious, we're going to get to your movie in just a second, but you have an interesting life story going before the movie and after the movie, and we're going to be covering a lot of different things. You were born in the United States, but you grew up most of the time, like your early childhood in Japan.
Yeah, I was born in South Carolina, and when I was 6 months old, we went to Japan. My father fought in the Korean War. He was wounded and got his combat infantryman badge and was convalescing in Japan in 1950, and he met my mother. And, of course, General MacArthur had a decree out that you couldn't have interracial marriages. So my father went back to the States, and he came back in 52 and then married my mom in early 1953 and then brought her back to the States. And then we came back right after I was born. I went home when I was about six, I think, to South Carolina. And when I was nine, we came back. And then my dad retired in 1969 when I was 13, and we came back to the United States. So the first 13 years of my life, I lived about 10 or so in Japan. So my first part of my early life was all growing up on military installation in Japan.
And to give listeners an idea, what is it like growing up on a military installation in another country? Because I think that's interesting, because most of us have never experienced that.
It's like Tokyo is a mess, man. I mean, there's just so much around the base that we lived on. I mean, our base was wide open. It's like you're in the United States. Like multi-level homes, a big shopping center. The gas station, you know, the baseball fields, delicatessen, all the stuff is on the base. And there's gates on different ends that access to the outside world. But while you're on that base, it's just like being in America. I mean, everybody speaks English, the school's English. Now, you go on to the commissary or the exchange or whatever, you have a bunch of Japanese people working there. And for me, it was fun because I spoke Japanese, you know, I mean, I didn't have any problems, you know, moving around. And then my Japanese family lived very close to the base. We didn't live very far from where I lived in the military. The first time we lived down in Yokohama, down by the bay at Camp Zama, because my dad was in the Army. And then the second time I went back, my dad was at Camp Drake. The 249th General Hospital was there. That's where guys would be flown in by helicopter from Tachikawa and Yokota from Vietnam. The kids weren't much older than I was, you know, and they would be all shot to hell and convalescing with their robes at the hospital. And I'd be going to the slot car track and making friends with them, because as soon as they got shipped back, they would give me all their stuff, you know. It's kind of interesting too. But you were basically on an island, but it was an American island in Japan. And it was actually very fun. I have a very close Facebook page group from them. I have friends from back when I was, you know, like 3 and 4, and also from when I was 9 to 13, and we're still very close. I go visit them. They come visit me sometimes. But, you know, they were some of my best friends growing up. It was an extremely fun time for me in my life, and I really enjoyed it over there. So, and you know, being part of the movie was just another, you know, feather in the cap. That just kind of fell on me, which was, you know, kind of neat too. So,
now also, you got an advantage by being that you were fluent in Japanese. That when you were watching television, you weren't stuck with just the stations that were English or English dubbed or whatever. You can watch everything, and you got to watch some great stuff.
When I was there, the FPN stations, the Far East Network stations that had English, they only had like weather and news. There was no TV shows. Everything was Japanese. Yeah, so you know, Godzilla, Gamera, Speed Racer, Magima Taishi, all the big shows when I was growing up, it was all in Japanese, and I understood it, and I had a, you know, like Ultraman and things like that. They were like my favorite shows. And all my American friends were just, you know, kind of bummed out because there was, you know, there was nothing there. So, and you know, we didn't have VHS or, you know, tape or anything back then. So like when we would go see movies at school, it was a big deal for the American kids. You got to actually see a motion picture that was in English. And the base theater, you know, God, it was 10 cents for a movie ticket. You know, I saw the Ten Commandments. You know, I saw El Cid. I saw some of the, you know, the biggest Hollywood blockbusters in the world for 10 cents at the base theater in Japan. It was awesome. Man. Massive theater, had about, I don't know, 700 or 800 seats in it with a balcony, and popcorn was a nickel, and you know, stuff like that. So that's where all the American kids, you know, every Saturday matinees in the morning, it was just fabulous. Roy Rogers and Westerns and, you know, stuff like that. It was great.
I just imagine, you know, when I grew up, I was watching Speed Racer and Ultraman when I'd come home from school, and then here you got to see them when they were first run, and that had to be, I mean, that's cool.
Yeah, and then my, you know, actually being in the movie, going to the set, and then learning a lot more about how those movies are made and where they were made and everything, you know, it piqued my interest even more about that kind of stuff. So, seeing those shows in their infancy, you know, were, you know, when you look back, well, you look back on that now, holy crap, that was like 50 years ago, you know, so 60 years ago coming up. So, pretty amazing to be able to see that stuff when it was brand new.
And speaking of seeing stuff up close, as you already alluded to with the movie, how did you get in Destroy All Planets? Because this is coming up on its fifth, it's actually just passed its 55th anniversary of its release in Japan.
Right.
So, you know, how did it all happen? Because it's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, so Yuasa Noriaki, the director, you know, he was the director of the first genre of, it's called the Showa era for the Gamera movies. And he had been asking for an American actor since about, I don't know, the third movie. I can't remember exactly which one. And they kept saying, no, 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 no. So finally, when you know, Gamera Tai Uchukaiju Virus, which is Gamera versus the Outer Space Monster Virus, which is the real title of the movie, was coming out in 1968, they let him try to get an actor in 1967. And they were looking for an American kid. And it just so happened that my mother's brother, my Japanese uncle, lived next door to a Daiei producer. And he was having a conversation with him one day and saying, man, we're trying to find an American kid that could speak Japanese well enough to do this movie. And we're just striking out, you know? And he said, oh, well, you need to call my sister. She married an American serviceman. They got a blonde, blue-eyed kid that speaks Japanese. Perfect, you know? So I came home from school, and my dad said, hey, we're going to go downtown. You're going to audition for a movie part. I was like, what does audition mean? And he said, tryout, you know, because I was a baseball player. Tryout. I said, oh, okay. What movie? And he said, the Gamera movie coming out. And I was like, ooh, all right, Gamera movie. You know? So we go downtown, and basically, the producer just talked to me. He just had a conversation. He asked me what I like to do, and you know, did I have sister or you know siblings, and you know, like how do I like Japan? What's my favorite food and all that kind of stuff like that. And talked to him for about 20 minutes, and he said, "Okay." And they whipped out a contract and laid it in front of us. They already had it written out. They were that sure, you know, because the guy that was a friend of my uncle said, hey, this guy speaks Japanese really good. This is going to be it. This is the guy. You're not going to have to look anymore. So we signed the contract right then and there. I mean, it was like four pages long. So my dad, you know, didn't think we needed to go, you know, run past the lawyer or anything. The interesting thing was I got no royalties because I was a foreigner. I wasn't a Japanese, you know, citizen. But that's how I got the part. And, you know, the next thing I know, they're coming to pick me up at 4 o'clock in the morning on base at Grand Heights to take me to the studio to shoot. And after about, I don't know, 2 weeks, my teacher was complaining to my mom and dad that I wasn't in class. And so they had to put a tutor in the car. So I had to study on the way to the studio, shoot all day, and then study on the way back. I'd get home around 8 o'clock. I had to go to bed, you know, by 8:30 or 8:45. So I could wake up at 3:45, you know, eat a piece of toast or something, drink a glass of orange juice, get in the car and go again. So that's how that started. And that's basically my extent. I mean, we went on location, you know, for a while. We stayed in hotels and stuff like that. But for the most part, I went every day. I left my house and went to the studio at Dye Motion Picture Studio. And it was about almost 2.5 months I missed school, which was cool in the fifth grade. So I got to take my whole fifth grade class to the premiere when the movie showed in downtown Tokyo. The Air Force gave us a big Air Force blue bus. And like I had like 18 or 20 kids in my class and my teacher. I think the principal came too, and we all rode the bus. Well, I didn't ride the bus. I was in the limo. They were in the bus. They went down. They got seated on a special seat in the balcony over all the people below, and they got to watch the movie from the balcony. So they had the spotlights in the sky, and all the stars were there. And I had to stay and sign autographs for a while, and they all piled in the bus and went back. You know, so I saw them in school the next week, and they thought that was really cool. So
they're probably
that was fun.
Carl, the movie star, you know, and that kind of thing. So, and at least your teacher then knew you weren't playing just hooky. You actually got to see, you know, you were in a movie.
Yeah. I still remember her too. Her name was O'Brien, Miss O'Brien. She was a kind of a strawberry blonde, freckled lady. She was really, really nice. I still remember her. I often wonder what happened to her. So, yeah.
Now, when filming it, what was it like? You know, some memories that you had during the production, you know, going through all that stuff. Because I'm sure you got to see some interesting, cool things, like the little yellow sub and all that other stuff.
Yeah, we started filming in February of 68. And to my surprise, the sets were not heated. So if you watch the movie, you see condensation coming off our breath. Because it was like 48 degrees inside the... There were 55-gallon drums with wood burning. We'd go up and warm our hands between shoots and stuff like that. You know, the spaceship set was one set, and they just changed the colors of the lights to make it look like a different, you know, room in the set. The floor was absolutely filthy. I mean, if you pay attention in the movie, when the Super Catch Kosen, the gold thing comes down and grabs us, I put my arm down, put my head on my arm. Because, I mean, in the very opening scene where Gamera destroys the first spaceship, he sticks his head in and shoots fire and stuff. They had a camera mounted on an inner tube. So it could, like, it bounced around. And guys are up in the rafter throwing buckets of trash and styrofoam and stuff out of the ceiling on the gantry. And all the stuff was falling down. And then they just swept that up a little bit. And so the rest of the shoot, all that stuff was down on the floor. You know, because they didn't think about it. There was only going to be one or two scenes where we were going to be laying on the floor there, you know, but it was absolutely filthy. Cold, filthy, a lot of piano wire, you know, and then the telepathy machine, when we were hungry, it would give us the juice and the sandwiches. The sandwiches were gross. If you watch very closely, I take a bite off this thing and I chew it, but I don't swallow it. I spit it out. It was so gross. I don't even remember what it was. I think it was liverwurst and cucumbers or something. And the drink glasses they were like irregularly shaped rims. So when you tried to drink it, you had to find a spot where the juice wouldn't fall out, you know, onto your chest and everything like that. But, there's a whole bunch of people on the set. There were probably, I have a picture of the entire set crew. I think it's in my presentation. I'll show you later, but, everybody, you know, they would come over and yik-yak with me and talk to me. And, you know, they were a lot of fun. I had a really good time with the people there. And Yuasa was a good director, but he had very little patience for, you know, us dorking around as 11-year-old kids, you know. Like the submarine set, they put a fish tank on one side to shoot the camera through the fish tank as, you know, we're on the other side. And, you know, we're zipping through the water at 15, 20 knots, and you'll see the fish, like, swimming around the fish tank right in front of the camera. They should be going, you know, be gone, you know, but they're not. And the bubbles are going straight up instead of, you know, going, you know, like where we're going. There were a lot of goofy things in the shooting. And then there was a bunch of mistakes. One of the best movies that we did was the 2010 release. In 2009, these guys contacted me and said they found my movie in an unopened tin. Had never been viewed before. So they wanted to know if I would do a commentator track for it. And I said I would. And so they digitally mastered that movie. They played it the very first time and digitally mastered it. And then I put the commentator track on it. But there are a lot of mistakes in the movie. Like I cut my finger in the estuary in the submarine scenes, and I had this big bandage on my ring finger. I have a big scar on this finger where it took a chunk of the meat off. Yuasa was not happy with me. I had to go to the emergency room. And so they put this rubber prophylactic over it. And so if you watch the movie, it's on, it's off, it's on, it's off, because we didn't shoot the scenes in sequence. Same thing with my neckerchief slide. I had an American Boy Scout uniform, and I forgot my neckerchief slide one time, one day. And we had to shoot, and they had to give me a Japanese neckerchief slide. So if you pay attention to the scenes, I have a silver one on, copper, silver, copper. So it goes back and forth, you know, things like that. You know, things like, and I point those things out in the movie, and then, you know, people have watched the movie multiple times have come up to me afterwards and said, man, after I watched that commentary track, I watched that, I paid attention and I saw all those things you talked about. And I said, yeah, I mean, it happens when you're, you've seen movies where the microphone shows up in the back of the scene and they don't ever edit it out because it's not worth it to do another take or whatever, you know? So goofy things like that. So I learned a lot about that. And then Yuasa invited us to one or two scenes because most of the movie was stock footage. They had to have a couple of scenes where Gamera was tearing stuff up. And he invited us in there. And Gamera, the guy in the rubber suit, literally fell down, was laying on his back and was like a turtle on his back, couldn't get up. And Masao and I were just laughing. We're just laughing our butts off, you know. And he ran us off the set. He was so mad at us because, you know, it's like, the red lights come on, the bell rings, quiet, action, you know, and then we're up there, we're laughing and stuff, and he had cut, you know, so he had to cut and kick us off the set because didn't trust us anymore to, you know, not mess up any scenes after that. So, yeah, it was quite an experience, you know, actually being in the movie and watching how it was done and everything else. So, I think what was interesting for me was in G-Fest, Yuasa and I were the guests of honor 1 year back around, I think it was 2010, somewhere in there, maybe earlier than that. But we sat down and he told me, he said, you know, for never acting, you had never acted before and you were 11 years old. And he goes, you were quite a good actor. You were pretty good. Your expressions on your face, how serious you were and things like that. And he goes, I never had to come in and coach you or tell you, you know. But he did have to come in and whack me in the head. You know, they call it a genkamochi, where they whack you in the head with a knuckle because I kept forgetting the line. You know, I'd mess up. We have to do about 6 or 7 takes, you know, because I'd mess up then. He'd get a little frustrated. But at that point, you know, he kind of understood. He said, well, this guy's an American kid. You know, it's Japanese. It's a complicated line. It's pretty technical. So he kind of cut me some slack a little bit, but not all the time. So, yeah.
I guess his patience only ran so far, and then he was just like, oh, I got to knock some sense into him.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what the Japanese people do when their kids don't listen or pay attention. They give you that genkamochi, knock you in the head one time, and maybe you'll remember, you know?
Now, I mean, obviously then, so you got to see the Gamera suit up close, so to speak, you know, and what was it like, you know, because I knew you saw one in the movies prior, and now you're going to see what it looks like. How do you make the sausage?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, the real suit was actually pretty cool. And, you know, the Gamera, you know, my Gamera was not so evil looking. You know, he was kind of a friendly looking face. Yeah, you had teeth sticking out and all that stuff like that. But he was, you know, I was probably 5'7" or so then, and this guy, the suit was probably 6 feet, 6 foot one, two, somewhere in there. It was pretty complicated and bulky. And I can't remember the guy's name that was the suit actor, but man, this guy was ripped. He had muscles on him because you had to have to lug that stuff around and pick up things and, you know, do things in it. And then the guy in the virus suit, similarly, you know, we actually had pictures taken where they took the tentacles and wrapped them around our neck and stuff. And I mean, you know, he was probably 7 feet tall with his, you know, his head and everything. But the skin, the rubber that his body and his skin was made out of was really scratchy and stuff. So when they put him around our neck, I mean, it literally, it hurt my neck. It scratched my neck. Then they had the miniatures when they spun him around and dropped him in the water and stuff like that. They had miniatures. So they were like, you know, a foot tall, 2 feet tall, like this, you know, not very big. And they had little sets where they had the rocket power. When in the head that shot the fire, Gamro's head that shot the fire, it was probably about, you know, regular size. It was probably the same size as the actual suit. They had a propane tank in the back, and they had a little piezo and igniter that would shoot the fire out and everything. And they literally, they'd catch the mouth of Gamera on fire. If you pay attention to the movie, his mouth is actually burning on the inside. They had to put it out after they shut the fire off and stuff like that. But, I mean, just watching some of the shoots, the suit, you know, when they were actually fighting and doing the stuff with the spaceship. And the spaceship was pretty cool, too. I mean, the huge model of the spaceship, the balls were, you know, beach ball size. They were pretty big like this to make that spaceship. So, yeah, it was pretty cool being an 11-year-old kid seeing all that stuff. You know, as an adult, probably I wouldn't be really excited about it. But as an 11-year-old kid, it was pretty cool. Yeah.
Now, you, of course, almost every one of your scenes, I think every part you're in it with your co-star, you know, or you know, whichever way you want to look at it. And what was it like working with him?
He was fun. I mean, he was really a good kid. We had a lot of fun together. He would come over sometimes. His mom would bring him over on the weekends, you know, during the shooting and after the shooting. And we were friends until I left in 1969. So, and then, you know, kind of stayed in touch with him through mail and stuff till about 1970, 1971. And then I kind of lost track of him because my mom told me that he had heard through his mother that he had kind of gone down the drug track and stuff like that. You know, he was sort of like, a childhood star in the United States, like, you know, Kurt Russell, mm-hmm. You know, was in everything, was in movies, was in TV, and he got really famous really fast. And he got into drugs and other stuff like that. And for the longest time, we thought he was dead. And we didn't even go looking for him. But somebody found him last year. They found him as a professor teaching thermal dynamics at some university in Tokyo about 7 years ago, the last that they know of. And I saw pictures of him, and I said, that's him. I mean, I recognized him right away from the pictures. So we're trying to get a hold of him. And you know, our manager, Linda Millenai's manager, is trying to get a hold of him so we can actually have a con together, because we're the only two surviving Gamera stars left. Everybody else is dead. I mean, you know, I'm 67 and he's 67. So we're two old farts, you know, running around out here, and not going to be much longer, that we'll be around. So it'd be really nice to be able to get together one more time, either in Japan or over here in the United States. To get him to come to a con, because I think that would be absolutely fabulous for the both of us were there for the event to talk about those kinds of things. Now, he didn't speak English very well, so I spoke Japanese to him all the time, which was kind of easy for him because he, you know, didn't have to labor and try to speak English, you know. But he did understand that I didn't have a 100% grasp of the language, so he was really good about, you know, coaching me and stuff like that. So I'd like to see him again.
And I know we've been referring to him by pronouns, but I'm afraid to butcher his name. But if you could say his name,
Takatsuka Toru was his name, and he was Masao in the movie, my partner. So,
Because you, obviously it's a buddy picture with the two of you. Or you could say a buddy picture, the two of you and Gamera, you know, so you can look at it a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, everywhere we went, you know, we hung out together, whether we were on set or not on set, you know, except for the time we were sleeping. We ate together, you know, we goofed off together. Yeah, so I got to know him pretty well during the shooting. And like I said, he came and visited me on the base and we'd play and, you know, go to the movies and do stuff on the base while my mom and his mom, you know, hung out together for a while. So it would be really nice to see him again, I think.
Now, during the movie, I thought it was interesting. They did American trait that a lot of other countries associate us with. You were proficient with the lasso as a character.
Oh, yeah. That was, I didn't even pay attention. When I got the script book, I was looking at the script book. I didn't even realize that, you know, until we got to that shoot. The first shoot we did on the lasso was actually, we did it on the submarine set on location where I take his hat off the flagpole. I mean, it was kind of simple because I didn't have to do a whole lot except, you know, and then throw the rope up in the air and then, you know, their effects took over. And then on the ship, when I grabbed the alien's arm and we pulled his arm off, that was the other time we did that. But my trademarks were my Polaroid camera and my rope. And, I still have Polaroid number two because I ruined Polaroid number one by jumping around on the sand and stuff like that. And we went to the submarine shoot, the button wouldn't go down anymore. And Yuasa was asking me what was wrong. And I opened it up and all the sand came out of the, you know, the first one. So they went and got me another one. And so that's the one I have that I bring to all my conventions and stuff like that. So the Polaroid camera, you know, which came out in 66 or 67, the Swinger was like extremely popular and very expensive at the time. And as everybody knows, you're supposed to take the picture, pull the film out, tear it off, shake it around and peel the two pieces apart. Well, I'm going click, 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 click. I'm just taking all, cause you know, nobody knew what that thing was back in 1968. So, you know, we got away with stuff like that in that movie otherwise, but. Yeah, had some interesting props and stuff that they, I guess the roping thing was sort of something that they decided that, you know, yeah, American Westerns or something, they had to throw something like that in there. So
yeah, so everybody knows, oh yeah, look, he's your typical American. All everybody always walks around with a rope and a lasso and lassos everything.
yeah, exactly.
And I still find that funny. You know, it's just, I was watching, I was like, oh, you know, he's like John Wayne. It'd have been really cool instead of naming me and Jim if it had been John.
yeah. Well, when I met Patrick Wayne, I showed him that clip of me lassoing stuff, and he looked at me and said, what in the world would they want you to do that for? I was like, probably because of your dad. I don't know. It's just, you know, one of those things, you know. So that was pretty cool.
It's one of those things that I guess for a lot of actors always, why do you have me do this? It's like, it's in the script. You know, it's like, okay, I'm getting paid. Yeah, exactly. I'm getting paid good money. I'll do it.
Yeah. Just shut up and do it. Exactly. Yeah.
Now during this time, you were also playing baseball and stuff like that. You alluded to when you were growing up.
Far East Network had, military installations in general had all these youth athletic programs because they had to do something to keep the kids occupied, you know? And so I played baseball. I played basketball, played football, I played everything, but baseball was like, you know, at the time was my, you know, biggest love. And the Japanese had some really good teams and some big stars in the time I was growing up in Japan. After the movie came out in 68, I was on the 69 World Pony League Baseball Championship team. We actually beat a team from Aviano, Italy, that came over from the European network to play with us, and we beat them 2 out of 3. And I won this trophy that was bigger than me that my dad said, we can't bring that back. So I left it in Japan, but it was a really big deal. But we would go out and play these little games with local Japanese teams. And I was a pitcher and a utility infielder. I basically played first base if I wasn't pitching. And we'd go to these Japanese schools, and I'd be warming up the infield, you know, catching the ball and throwing and catching the ball. And some Japanese kid would come up to me and say, "Excuse me, are you Carter Craig?" And I go, "Yeah." And then the whole dugout would empty because they recognized me, you know. And so I would be signing bats and balls and gloves and stuff for about 15 minutes. And, you know, the umpire's like, "Come on, let's play ball," you know. So then we'd play. So, and then when I go see my grandmother, my mom would take me out to go, you know, clean or help my grandmother's house. I'd sweep, and my grandmother would give me like 200 yen, which at the time was probably about 75 cents. And I could be gone for a couple of hours with 75 cents in Japanese yen. And all the kids in my grandmother's neighborhood knew who I was. So I'd go play with them. You know, they'd take me into their house and go, "Hey, look, it's Jim Morgan from the Gamera movie." You know, and the parents would be like, "Ooh, you know, that's cool." So yeah, I do that kind of stuff. But yeah, that was, you know, playing baseball. I was actually coming back from a practice or a game that we did to this little baseball team right outside the base at Grant Heights. And the poster of my movie was still hanging on a telephone pole. And my buddies go, "Hey, isn't that you?" And I was like, "Holy crap, it is. It's me." So I peeled that poster off the wall and folded it up. And I had it in my scrapbook. I was 12, right? I folded it all up. So I completely destroyed this thing. I don't know how the thing survived as long as it did sitting on this telephone pole where it was. But, I mean, it was after the movie had come out. So it was that summer. So it probably been hanging up there for months, and I happened to grab it and pull it off. It's pretty tattered and everything, but even my buddies recognized that. "Hey, there's your movie, and there you are on the poster," you know, kind of thing. So that was kind of cool too. But yeah, that was the stuff that you did when you were a military brat on a military base. You had to have something to do. Slot cars, sports, movie theater, you know, bowling alley, things like that. They had to have something for you guys to stay occupied while you're over there. Otherwise, you'd be on the outside market, and there was just really nothing for you to do out there as an American kid. So.
Yeah, and of course, unlike other American kids that were there, at least you could speak Japanese, so you actually could go and do a lot of different things where they were
I could do things limited. That they couldn't. And yeah, exactly. So they were more of a captive audience on the base than I was, because I mean, my family lived off base. We would go off base and, you know, to see them all the time. So I mean, most of the people that I knew that were American kids stayed on the base. They didn't go off base unless they were keenly interested in what was going on, you know, with Japan. You know, I have a really good friend of mine. He's an Air Force retired colonel. He's an F-4 and F-16 pilot. He was a great baseball player. His dad is my coach in Japan. I mean, he just loves Japanese food. He loves the he has all kinds of Japanese art in his house, and he's a real big, you know, fan of that. So I mean, some of the kids really accepted it. And you know, if you talk to Linda Miller, she'll tell you the same thing. You know, she went over there kicking and screaming. She did not want to go there. And then when she got there and she learned about the country and the people, she said she really loved it and she really, you know, enjoyed it. And the funny thing is, Linda lived on the same base as I did. She lived across the street about a block down from me. And she made her movie in 67 and I made mine in 68. And neither one of us were trying to be movie stars. It just fell into our laps. And she was, you know, 8 or 9 years older than I was. So she wasn't running around in my circle. So I didn't know who she was. She didn't know who I was. And it wasn't until all these years later that we finally figured out, holy crap, we were like, you know, a block away from each other growing up over there when all this happened. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting.
It's amazing. It's a small world. But what are some of the other big differences that you noticed in American life and in Japanese life, you know, like culture-wise, that you might want to point out? You know, because obviously you being able to experience both.
Well, they go to school for 50 weeks of the year. Summer vacation is 2 weeks. I mean, math intensive. They're very structured, regulated. The society in itself, I mean, you could leave something on a train and nobody would take it. Nobody would ever steal anything. They would turn it in. my mom, when she was growing up, you know, she would tell me about the stuff that she had to eat during the war, World War II, because there just wasn't a lot of food there. And that's another reason that you look at the Japanese people, they're very small people, you know, back in that day. But if you go there now, like my wife and I went back there, the last time we were there was 2005. But we were on the train and there were kids as big as we were, you know. So McDonald's and all these Western diets and everything, you know, coming in, nutrition levels are different and everything. So the Japanese society is completely grown. But it still amazed me to see five-year-old little girls and boys getting on the train by themselves to go to school. But no chaperones or, you know, it's just absolutely amazing. That society over there. Clean. I mean, I can show you pictures of downtown Tokyo, random streets. There's no trash. There's no garbage. You know, it's nothing like if you go up into South Philly or go up in New York or something like that, you know, L.A. I mean, even I lived in San Diego. There was some pretty crappy parts of San Diego. There's just trash on the streets, garbage, you know, rusted up cars sitting out in the streets. Stuff. Nothing like that in Japan. It's just completely different. So.
That's pretty cool. And other things that you did, you enjoyed growing up, I think, was you had a thing with planes. You always wanted to be a pilot.
Yeah. I mean, we would go to Tachikawa Air Force Base and we would go to Yokota Air Force Base. Yokota is the only one that's still there. But Yokota and Tachikawa back in the day had like heavy lift aircraft, C-141s, C-130s and stuff like that. They were transport planes. And, you know, they had helicopters and stuff that would go back and forth between all the other installations in Japan. Misawa was another base that was north of Tokyo. It was an F-16 base. As a matter of fact, that's where I got my F-16 assignment in the Air Force. And then they took it away and sent me to Korea in the F-4 again. So that's when I quit and got out of the Air Force. But I had this fascination with planes since I was little. And my mom used to say I'd put my arms behind my back and make noises as soon as I could walk. And growing up, I was, you know, I was watching From Here to the Moon TV show the other day, and my daughters were asking questions. My little one, and I was telling her how I wanted to be an astronaut. You know, I wanted to be a jet jockey and an astronaut. And I have my F-104 over here on my plane section. This is the one that, you know, is in the right stuff. Chuck Yeager crashes it. In the movie.
Yep.
But that airplane was the airplane that basically made me want to be an Air Force pilot. It was just such a cool airplane. It was so fast and so sleek and everything. And that was like the impetus to that. So growing up, you know, even though I played every sport, I was a jock, I could have probably, you know, I had a bunch of scholarships, but I ended up going to college on an Air Force pilot scholarship. Now, of course, this was right after the Vietnam War. I got my scholarship in 1974 for 4 years and graduated in 78. Nobody wanted to go in the military because Vietnam was still going on. And so they just figured if you stay away from all that, you know, you won't have a chance of going over there. Well, I was like, yeah, I wanted to fly. And so I went in and I did that. And so I was able to, you know, do my dream as a kid, become a pilot. And I flew fast jets, I flew F-4s, and I flew the T-38, I flew a bunch of really cool airplanes. And then everything that the Air Force gave me from that training to be an officer and a pilot, you know, I used in my career afterwards in every job that I had. After I got out of the Air Force, I went to work for the Customs Service in the Treasury Department as a pilot. And I worked through that. We were the largest law enforcement Air Force in the world, all the way up to about, I don't know, 10 years ago. And I did 20 years with them, 20 years with the Air Force. I retired from both. And then I was in the business development world where I was a vice president of a helicopter company and a vice president of Cessna Aircraft, where I was selling airplanes and helicopters because that's, you know, that's what I did. So I was in that world for another 10 years out there after my military career. So, you know, 50 years, when you look at it all, total combined time, 50 years of service between, you know, the Treasury Department, Customs, the Air Force, and then my business development world is all about airplanes and helicopters. So, I mean, I have all kinds of airplanes and helicopters on my bookshelf back here. And I have a whole section of Gamera. I've got, you know, monster stuff, too. But yeah, that was the other thing. I wanted to be a pilot, and you know, I tell my kids, I said, hey, I got to live my dream. I dreamed that, you know, people say they want to be a fireman, they want to be a nurse or a doctor or something like that. And if they get to do that, that's absolutely awesome. And I did. So I can at least say that I did what I wanted to do when I was a little kid. Now, I never became an astronaut. I mean, that would have been, you know, probably the coolest thing. But yeah, there was no avenue for that at the time because, you know, all that stuff, we had stopped going to the moon. Nobody cared about going into space anymore. And then for the longest time, the only thing that was out there was like space shuttle, you know, things like that. So it wasn't anything like it, you know. So, I mean, it's getting all fired back up again, you know, with all the new programs going back to the moon and farther and beyond and everything. So maybe I'll live long enough to see something else like that or see us go back to the moon at least. That'd be cool.
Well, you already got to go in a spaceship. So, you know, when you were a boy.
Yeah, I know. I mean, yeah. Yeah, 11 years old, got to go into a spaceship. And, you know, and I was a really brave kid because there's that scene in there where Masao and I told the Japanese Defense Force, go ahead and shoot us down. You know, we'll die and we'll give our lives for our, you know, for the Earth or whatever. And my mom was, that's really hilarious. Yeah, you know, like two 11-year-old kids could make a decision like that, you know. But anyway.
And the Earth will surrender rather than sacrifice the two boys.
Exactly. Like, you know, like that would happen now. They would say, blow that thing up. Sorry about that. You know, but
there wouldn't even have been hesitation, but it's just, you know, that's real life compared to the movies.
Yep.
But you also, I noticed when you and I, before we started the interview, we're doing this as a Zoom call, and behind you, you have a plethora of guitars, and you and I are talking about your musical talent. You know, if you want to bring that up and talk about some of this, your love of music.
Well, you know, it's funny. My dad played a guitar, and he used to sing country western music, and he was really big into country western music. And you know, he was a military enlisted man. And when I started growing my hair got like right now, it's just barely over the ears, man. I was like, he'd grab me by the scruff of my neck and take me to the barbershop, you know? And as soon as I started growing my hair out, I started playing rock and roll music. Oh man, there was just hell to pay for that. But, I got my first electric guitar in Japan when I was like 12, and I had that guitar until I was about, I don't know, 13 or 14, I guess. And then I saved my money up and bought a 1972 Les Paul. I have a Les Paul. It's this one right there. That's a studio Les Paul. It's a real Gibson Les Paul. But I had a custom gold top, 1972. I think I spent, I want to say $1,300 on that guitar in 1972. I mean, you could buy a car in 1972 for $4,000. Or $3,000, brand new car. And I bought this guitar and I sold it, you know, thinking, and I made money on it. And I was thinking, man, I did really well, but that guitar right now is probably worth 10 grand. I had it. I wish I still had it. But I played in bands when I was a kid, you know, grew my hair out. We were playing Smoke on the Water as soon as it came out. Any of the Allman Brothers stuff. I was kind of a country rock kind of a guy. Lynyrd Skynyrd was, you know, a big favorite later on, but I was already past that, you know, age where I was playing in clubs when I was 17. My dad, you know, told me if they arrest you because you're under 18 in a place where they're serving alcohol, I'll come get you when you're outside the jail, because he was a cop. And, you know, he warned me many times, but I played in bars and clubs when I was in high school and, you know, kept going through. And over the years, I've you know, bought all kinds of stereo equipment. I built a studio in my Georgia house. I mean, a no kidding studio. And I have a recording deck and I have a bunch of amps. And I still record and play music. I have friends that come over and we get together and play a little bit. Jay Johnson, big Kaiju fan. His daddy was part of the original Swampers down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, played backup music for all the big stars. He ran his recording studio. I've been to his dad's studio. His dad passed away about 3 years ago. But I saw platinum and gold records from Lynyrd Skynyrd and, you know, all kinds of different stars. But, you know, I still enjoy playing and recording and, you know, doing that stuff. There was one stretch when I was in Georgia, I had there was a website called Pure Volume, and you could post your music on it by your zip code, and people would look me up, and I had people calling me, wanting me to come play in clubs, and offered me $75 a set, three sets, free beer, you know, just sit over in the corner and play my guitar with my backup box, you know, my backup band. And, I never did it. My wife said, you should go do it at least one time just to see what that's like, you know, but I was living in, you know, just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And I was thinking I'd go to these little hole in the wall bar down there, and you never know what I'd be running into down there. But I probably should have done it once just to get a, you know, get a feeling of it. But, yeah, I still play. I mean, I don't have the calluses on my finger like I normally do, but I still play. One of the Zoom calls I did not too long ago, I actually played one of the songs on the Zoom call that I recorded on my deck that I have. Because when I record, I use like two or three, I use both acoustic guitars, my electric acoustics, and I use one or two of my electrics, and I record all that, and I mix it all down onto the song, and I play them back that way. So it sounds pretty good, actually. If you burn it down to a CD and throw it in your car, sounds just like anything you'd buy at the store. But yeah, I've been playing for a long time, since I was probably, 13. So I've been playing the guitar for a long time.
It's amazing. You have such diverse interests. And the thing is you pursued them and had a lot of fun and enjoyment with them. And that's the key thing, I think, is to, if you have an interest, you go for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, I tried to get my sons to get into music, and they were like, I bought my oldest son a starter Telecaster with a Stratocaster, Fender Stratocaster with a little amp and everything, and it just sat in the closet. And one day I came home and I heard him playing it, and he told me about tablature, and I was like, what the heck is that? Well, I mean, I never learned how to read music, so I made them take music in school so they could learn how to read music, sheet music, because I thought that would help them, you know, where I didn't have that. Like, if I wanted to learn how to play a song, I had to record it on a cassette tape, which nobody knows what that is anymore. I would record it six or seven times on each side, and I'd stick it in my car, and I'd listen to the song over and over and over again. I'd learn it by ear, and I'd be able to play the song the next day or a couple of days later by ear, because I'd listen to all the notes and everything. Well, both of my sons ended up getting into it, singing, playing the guitar, and everything else, and they actually sang at my wife and I's wedding back in 2005 on the stage at the church in front of the entire, you know, assembly of guests and family and everything like that. So that was a really, you know, fun thing that they did for me on that. And they sang the song, Every Thug Needs a Lady. So they play, they still play. And so I guess, you know, the big thing is that when I pass, they'll get the oldest one gets to pick first, and they'll just sort through everything I got back there. And I leave the acoustics to my girls, so hopefully they'll be able to play them by then if they're interested in that at all. So,
I just find it fascinating. And as one of the listeners know, there's always one of these things I always tell people when I'm interviewing somebody. I always say, why don't you ask this question or that question? And my thing is, as well, you go to a lot of different conventions. Like we said, you're a Monster Bash. You're at a lot of conventions that are in the Virginia area, you know, in the surrounding states, because you live in Virginia. But you're also going to be at a convention on November 12th with Linda Miller, the New Jersey Collectors Fest up in Wayne, New Jersey, which is a Sunday convention for one day. What time does it start and go to? Do you know?
I think it's 9 to 5. On that day, there's a bunch of great stars are going to be at this one too. The ones we've been to before up there, Linda and I have gone around the country. I've been to Indianapolis, Chicago, Dallas. We were out in California a couple of years ago, and we go to the Bash in Pittsburgh, and then we used to go to the one in New Jersey. So it all depends on, you know, I think we were doing a lot more cons before COVID, and When COVID hit, I mean, it just bottomed out. So we were doing Zoom calls like this, so our fans could get on the call and ask us questions and things like that. But, you know, it was what we could do to keep the fan base up. I have about 1,600 followers on my Facebook page. I don't make an effort to go out and promote it or go any farther, but my business card that I have basically has a link to my website. And that way people can, you know, learn more about, I've got all my pictures on there, my family, my hobbies, my personal life, my real life jobs and stuff like that. And then there's all kinds of pictures, that autographed pictures that you can get, videos, things like that. But I have all that posted on there for informational purposes. And I get a lot of visits after I go to cons where people meet me for the first time. Then they go to the cons. Then they show up on my Facebook page. And, you know, I try to stay on my Facebook page once or twice a month and say something or do something. And most of the time I'm promoting Linda going to some other show, and then she turns around and promotes me going to some other show. But typically when we do these shows, like these New Jersey show, Linda will drive up from Richmond, spend the night here, we'll fix her dinner. And Saturday morning, we'll pile our stuff in the car and we'll drive up to New Jersey. And then we'll do the show on Sunday, and then we'll drive back on Monday. And then she'll get in the car and drive from my house back down to Richmond in the going out of D.C. traffic at 3 o'clock. The other day when we came back from Pittsburgh, it took her 4 hours to get home from my house. It's a 2-hour drive. It's bad. So, but anyway, we go to as many of these as we can. And we typically promote them on our website and our Facebook page. So, you know, you just have to kind of keep track of it.
And for listeners wondering, what is the name of your Facebook and site and your website?
It's destroyallplanets.com, and Destroy All Planets has hyphens in it, because what happened was my original destroyallplanets.com webpage, I let that URL lapse, and then I have somebody cyber squatting it. They want $3,000 for that webpage. So I just started another one. It said destroy-all-planets-.com or .com. Started a new one for $19.95 and built my new webpage, and I have a whole new webpage there. And my Facebook one, I got to remember, I think it's just Destroy All Planets. Let me see on my other computer here what it actually is. I can't remember which one it is. What does it say up here? Oh, it's Facebook.com Gomera versus Virus. After Facebook.com. / Gomera versus Virus is the website. But I think if you just type in Gomera versus Virus or Gomera and Virus, I think if you type in Virus, it will show up. But that's my Facebook page. So I post something on there all the time. And I also, you know, keep everybody up to speed on anything that we're doing, any cons that are upcoming or whatnot. And then, you know, Linda and I were talking on the drive back from Pittsburgh a couple weeks ago that we might start doing some more Zoom calls again. I used to have a pro Zoom account so we could go more than an hour. I'm probably going to have to go reinvest and get another pro Zoom account again so we can start doing those again. Because what Linda and I do is we have a little PowerPoint presentation that basically talks about our careers and what we do. And then we have a Q&A session, and we just, you know, we've stayed on there for like 3 hours. And we recorded the show, and so people ask us, you know, to send them a copy or give them the link for the recorded version of the show so they can, you know, watch it again or use it again later and listen to themselves asking their questions on the Q&A session. So that plays out pretty well, too.
And what I do is those sites that you brought up, I'll have links to them in the show notes. So people that are driving, you know, you can go on our Facebook page, Diecast Movie Podcast Facebook page, or wherever you're listening to it on the podcast, if you go in the notes for the show, the links will be there.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day. I know we're doing this early in the morning, you know, for, you know, and stuff like that, but we're getting it done, and I'm glad your voice finally came back and
oh, yeah, like that. Well, I'm glad you could take care of your plumbing problem too. You know, life gets in the way sometimes. So, I mean, today it's actually cold here, you know, so you felt that too. And I was wondering whether or not that had anything to do with your plumbing issue. But I mean, it was cold. My little, you know, dachshund, she did not want to walk around the block yesterday. She was like running. She didn't want to be out there. And then when I brought her inside, she ran right over to the fireplace and got in her bed right next to the fireplace. She just hunkered down. My father-in-law and I are going to go hit golf balls today at this place. It's kind of like what's it called? Golf. I forgot what those places are called now. But they have like a lot of ranges, and they have a shot tracker, and it's heated, and you can get lunch there and everything else. So that was one of the other things I just recently did. I won my super senior club champion at my golf course. I broke 70 when I was 13, and I've come in second, third, fourth, and fifth in a club championship my whole life. I'd never won one. And last year when I started playing again, after a long layoff, I realized I couldn't hit the ball out of my way anymore. I was like, God, what has happened? And my father-in-law said, you're getting old, man. You just can't swing as hard and everything. So anyway, I dedicated myself to winning this tournament. And as a matter of fact, my wife and my daughters went on vacation this summer, and I didn't go with them. And they were asking me why. And I said, because I'm playing in the club championship, you know, and I gotta be ready. And they were like, so my wife was like, you're kidding me, you know? So had I not won, I'd probably been hell to pay for it. So, so now my big emphasis is to defend my title, because I got a parking spot right in front of the clubhouse that has my name on it and got my name on the plaque. I got a little trophy. I brought my trophy home not too long ago. And my little daughter said, did you get money? Were you on TV? You know, because she watches me watch PGA golf on the television all the time. So she thought it was like, I was like that. I was getting a big trophy, you know, about that big, and all this money, millions of dollars. And I'm like, no, I didn't do that. So
I got a parking spot. I got a parking spot that's more than money.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's actually very cool. Yeah, I never even realized that until they told me that that's what you get when you win. So then there's a spot right over there, so I can drive it in there and park in my spot now. It's pretty cool. It says club champion on. But, so I got to win next year, too. I got to practice and keep playing. And then, you know, up here in this weather in the winter, man, there is no golf time. I mean, so I built my own driving range right next to the house. I have a net and a whole area of synthetic grass, and I have my shot tracker so I can hit balls this winter, so I can keep swinging until it gets to the point where I can get back out there and play on the real grass again. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, congratulations on winning that, and good luck with retaining the championship, you know, not losing it.
Defending my title.
Yes, 2 years in a row, yeah. Hopefully. Hopefully it'd be repeat.
Yeah, it's for the old guys. It's everybody over 65 in my club. There's like 30 players at my club that are over 65. And so, it's kind of a big deal now for me, because I gotta win it one more time. I like to win it two or three times. I tell my kids about this one guy that I grew up with. His name's on the plaque at my home course where I grew up on. His name's on the plaque 17 times. That is a legacy. So, yeah, I don't think I'll get on there 17 times. Don't have enough time for that. But, he was on there 17 times. He was that good. So, anyway.
He was like the Michael Jordan of that club.
Exactly. And he was an old guy when I was a young guy. He was still kicking everybody's butt. So, it makes me feel better that I can be like him when he was in his 60s. Yeah. Because he was still winning when he was in his 60s. Because he was that good. So, I've kind of started late in that respect, but that's okay. I'm happy. I got my one championship.
Well, Carl, thanks for joining me, and I'm glad we got to talk about your complete filmography.
Okay. Glad to be here.
And listeners, again, New Jersey's Collectors Fest this November 12th, 2023, up in Wayne, New Jersey. Carl is going to be there. Linda Miller is going to be there. And I believe one of the other people, if I remember correctly, he said is going to be there, is Marta Kristen from Lost in Space. So there's lots of people that are going to be there. You should go if you're in the area. Go have some fun and get to talk to all three of them. Hello, everybody. Again, I want to thank Mr. Craig for joining me on today's episode of Diecast Movie Podcast. And if anybody wants to leave us feedback, please email us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page, feel free to share the episode. And again, if you enjoy the interviews and the movie discussions and you don't want to miss an episode, you know, make sure that you're following us or whatever podcast catcher you're using. And that way, the next episode comes up, you automatically will get notified. And feel free to share us on whatever social media you're using, whether Facebook, Instagram, whatever, you know, Twitter or X as it's called now. Also, I want to say, as Mr. Craig or Carl basically talked about how he plays the guitar and everything like that, he was kind enough to share one of his instrumentals, Quiet Before the Storm, with me, and he said I can play it. So we're going to be listening to that to end the episode. So I hope everybody that's in the New Jersey area goes out there and sees Carl Craig and Linda Miller when they're at the show. And the information for the show is going to be on our show notes. So feel free to follow along, click on the link, go there, get to meet them in person, and so on. I hope everybody has a great day. And I'll talk to you guys later. Now let's go to the music.